Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Carl Johengen. Johengen is a conductor, singer, teacher, and composer. He received his master's degree in singing and choral conducting from Ithaca College and his doctorate of musical arts from the Eastman School of Music. He currently teaches voice at Ithaca College's School of Music. He is also a choir director at Wells College and is conductor of the highly acclaimed Cayuga Vocal Ensemble, Ithaca's elite 20-voice chamber choir. He continues to be active as a singer as well, performing in many venues in New York, including Alice Tully and Avery Fisher Halls. And welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tish. I'm really delighted to be here.
Yeah. I have to talk to you about your interest in music. I know it began at 6. You started with the piano. You segued at 9 to the oboe. And so tell us where this passion came from.
Well, I grew up in a house where there was always music around. My father was a really fine amateur pianist, played piano from a very young child. My first piano lessons were from the same crotchety old man that he had taken piano lessons from years before.
Wow.
But he would sit down and just play to relax. And he was also the volunteer organist in the little tiny church I grew up in my town. By the time I was 6 and was starting to take piano lessons, I would just enjoy going up into the choir loft and watching him play. And, by the time I got good enough, he would press me into service to play sometimes. So,
wow.
So I think I was just primed for a life of music making, from a very early age.
Yeah.
I can remember a lot of my spare time when I was young, pouring through my dad's collection of LPs. The oboe came about for me because I remember listening to my dad's LP of Peter and the Wolf that was narrated by Lorne Greene
Bonanza.
Yeah. And I just thought the sound of the duck in Peter and the Wolf with that oboe was so plaintive and so pathetic, and I just thought it was so beautiful.
So it struck you emotionally.
I thought
that was such an unusual instrument for a 9-year-old.
Yeah, well, not a lot of people start on the oboe, but I had a good in my little elementary school where I grew up, a quite good instrumental music teacher who had he was a flutist primarily, but he had played a lot of oboe. So he felt equipped to start me, and because I was interested in it, he said, oh, by all means, if you really think you want to do that, go right ahead.
That's great.
And so I started playing the oboe when I was 9.
God, that's unbelievable. So you were going to be an oboist, and then you decided to segue into choral music. And why did that come about?
Well, I think, it was growing up where I did. I grew up in a very small town in western New York, south of Buffalo, literally 500 people, no stoplights. a tiny little, elementary school that was just, K through 5, and then had to take a long bus ride to junior high. I didn't have a lot around me as far as models for what a life in professional music could be like. I could imagine that, that you could play in an orchestra. And I did hear growing up, we drove into Buffalo and heard the Buffalo Philharmonic very often.
Oh, yeah.
And, listening to my father's LPs and all. I really don't know that I had a notion that you could make a living as a singer or as a choir director. So I figured, well, I love to play the oboe. I love music. I want to be a musician. I set out that I was going to be a symphony oboe player. And, of course, when I came to Ithaca College, I had some fantastic opportunities as an oboist, but I also got exposed to all this other different music because here were all my friends that were voice majors and were singing in choir. And I heard all this great music. Having played piano from age 6, I was able to make a little money on the side when I was in college accompanying musicians, being a piano collaborator with other musicians. I wasn't such a great pianist that I could play really difficult, orchestral, concerto accompaniments. I could play, though, art songs of Schubert and Fauré and some of these other composers.
So that sounds like a good way to segue into
exactly.
Choir.
So I got hooked on all this gorgeous repertoire and would go with my singers that I was playing for. I would go with them to their lessons and I would see what they were doing. And I started to realize that singing was pretty amazing. And my junior year at Ithaca, I auditioned for and got a spot in the select choir that at that time was conducted by Larry Dobler. And he became a real mentor to me. I ended up singing in his choir and going on tour. And then later on, when I came back to Ithaca for my master's degree, I studied choral conducting with him as well as voice.
You know, I wondered how one segues from performance to becoming a conductor, which is also a form of performing, obviously. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it's a different art.
Absolutely. But I think the best conductors really have a lot of experience as performers themselves. Choral music is very interesting because there's an awful lot of people that work in choral music that don't have their background primarily in singing. Mm. They have it in, you know, there's plenty of church musicians, organists that also work as choral conductors. And I'm sure some of them are very fine. I've worked with many that are excellent, but there are also a lot that really don't have a great foundational knowledge of how the voice works. And I think sometimes it can really trip them up because they really have to depend on their singers to share the wisdom of, that's not really going to work. I need to breathe here or that tempo is not going to really work.
I've always thought conductors had to be teachers in part, you know, and it seems to me that you'd have to know how to sing.
Yeah, certainly with choral conductors, absolutely.
Yeah.
I consider myself pretty lucky that I've had so much experience as an instrumentalist, as a pianist, but then also as a singer, and I think it really equips me pretty well to face anything I need to face as a conductor.
We have to talk about how did you get this gig in 2009 as the conductor of the Cuga Choral vocal ensemble.
It's
such a gorgeous group of people.
I love working with these people. It's interesting. I had been just a couple of years on the faculty at Ithaca College when I found out that Larry Dobler was actually going to give up leading the Cayuga Vocal Ensemble. He was gradually sort of winding down for his retirement. He retired just last year from Ithaca College. And, you know, was gradually sort of giving up the extra things he was doing, the choir at the Presbyterian Church as well. So when I heard that they were looking, I really thought long and hard about it. Living over in Bath, as I do, I'm about an hour west of Ithaca, even though at this point now my professional life really revolves around Ithaca.
Yeah,
I thought about, you know, the time it would take for me to actually lead the group and whether that was going to present any difficulties as far as, you know, being in Ithaca enough, you know, the commuting, et cetera. So I won't say that I, you know, jumped right on the bandwagon, but got some really strong encouragement from the folks on the committee that were, you know, I was, you know, talking with them about, you know, what was involved in terms of applying for the job. And in the end, I just became pretty convinced that I should go for it.
Oh, and, absolutely. And I'll bet your little wheel started turning in regard to the creative stuff you
absolutely.
Could do.
I can't imagine anybody in music, you know, imagining themselves in a particular position with an ensemble and not starting to fantasize about what kinds of things you could do with a group like that.
I want to play an excerpt while we're talking about the Cuga Vocal Ensemble. I want to play an excerpt from one of the performances. This is called Coming Through the Rye. You want to give us a little bit of setup of where
absolutely.
This was?
And... Absolutely, yeah. Earlier this year in March, we did a concert that is called Celebrating Scotland, and it really was one of the most fun programs I've had with them. It was so much fun to put together. And we had a great time rehearsing it. I have to say, great thanks to the board and the singers of the vocal ensemble for letting me sort of have free rein with all of my programming, I do have to say. But this one especially because it has a little bit of a personal connection. Just a couple of years ago, I discovered my own Scottish roots. And so that was sort of the inspiration to do this program called Coming Through the Rye. And we perform a lot a cappella, and I just did not find all that many really great arrangements of familiar Scottish tunes like Coming Through the Rye. So I did this arrangement myself, and we're going to hear just the last couple of verses of it.
Yeah, let's listen to it.
His name, or where's his name, I did not give to
I love, for one thing, I just love choirs. And this I was at that performance, the Scotland performance.
Yeah.
And it was so beautiful. It was my introduction to your ensemble, and it was an absolute perfect place for me to start because it was so gorgeous. Now, as a conductor, arranger, and stuff, how do you decide how to meld the voices together? Is it one step here with the sopranos? How do you do that?
Well, it's... As I think with a lot of artistic media, getting to know your options, getting to know how many possibilities there are, I've not really ever had any formal training as a composer, but you know, working as a professional musician and hearing what other composers are doing, this is how we learn. We learn mm-hmm. what the possibilities are because the great composers have shown us the amazing array of options, and when working with singers. Yeah, it's not like having 88 keys on the keyboard or an entire symphony orchestra of different timbres,
mm-hmm.
but there are so many possibilities with the way you can work the voices together, you know, having different textures of single voices, having the sopranos, altos, tenors, basses divide up into more parts. Composers like Eric Whitaker, who's kind of like choral music's it boy right now. Everybody wants to hear and perform his music. He'll compose pieces in which there are chords that have, you know, 12, 15, 20 individual notes in them that the various singers have to sing. And it's thrilling. It really is very, very exciting. But working with a piece like Coming Through the Rye, you know, trying to preserve the charm and the recognizability of the tune is kind of freeing in a way because you've got that already there as a given, and then you can really work around that to create some.
It seems to me that conductors and people who compose and arrange are playing with our emotions.
Well, I hope so.
More so than anything else.
Yeah, I sure hope so.
Trying to bring the emotions out.
If it's
yeah.
not going to create an emotional response in the audience, why bother?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I just think it becomes something of an academic exercise then, and I think that's really too bad. It should be something that stirs emotion in the audience, and that's one of the things that I love working with CVE, with just, you know, 20 singers. We really can have these discussions. I mean, they're singing at a very high level. We're rehearsing. They're coming with the notes already learned. So generally we're not having to do a lot of those nitty-gritty details. We're really able to talk right away about, you know, what is the response that we want from the audience? What is here in this piece of music, textually as well as musically, that moves us and that then we in turn want to try to move
how
the
you
audience.
Can convey
yeah.
It, yeah,
absolutely.
You know, I understand being a musician, a singer, doing all the arts that you do. Not everybody who gets into these professions wants to teach. Now, was that a natural for you? It sounds like it probably was.
You know, it took me a little while to appreciate how that was going to fit into my life as a musician. I think, you know, it's a rare person who goes into music professionally who doesn't do some teaching.
Mm.
Part of my being an oboist back in the day, I was in a degree program where I was both preparing potentially to, you know, play professionally, but also to teach, you know, high school band or something like that. And I remember my first teaching experiences as a student with faculty supervision and with guidance and all, feeling very, very out of my element and very unsure of myself and very uncomfortable. Mm. But once I started working as a singer and as a choral conductor and I got out into the world and started working not necessarily just with young people, but with people my own age and adults. My first job out of grad school was as a church musician, as a director of music at a very, very large church in the Buffalo area. You know, here were these amateur singers who just had this great love of singing and this great desire to come together and create this amazing thing called choral music. And instantly I knew that teaching was for me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Carl Johengen. He's a conductor, singer, teacher, and composer. Now you teach voice on a private basis, too.
I do.
What are some of the important factors for someone really wanting to have a career as a classical singer?
Well, it's extremely multifaceted. That's one of the things that makes it interesting for me because I'm just never bored. And every singer that I've worked with has had something unique that they've had to deal with in terms of their own development as a singer. So a voice teacher really has to stay on his toes. It's a great combination of the aesthetic, of the literary, helping a student get excited about the music and the words that he's going to sing, and also the beautiful emotive quality of the music. Underneath everything, though, is the physicality of learning to sing.
And I
do feel strongly that that's an area that can be a little uneven in terms of what, you know, students that have come to me come in with a great appetite to sing and a great desire to learn about the music and to be performers, but they maybe have had an incomplete training in terms of their physical instrument, and they're not really singing up to their potential. And so I just really love working with these singers. I like to think of myself in a way, you know, kind of like a coach working with an athlete, you know, somebody who's with them in the gym, like helping an elite athlete, perfect their performance. They have to be in the gym, you know, working their individual muscle groups and getting singers to understand it's not necessarily a given that they have to sing the way they're singing. They can learn to retrain their muscles to do it in an efficient, physically relaxed, easy way that can really enhance their tone and their ability to perform.
Yeah, yeah.
I just love it. I love working with singers and singers of all ages.
Yeah, yeah. I want to play an excerpt of you singing before we run out of time. The excerpt you chose was called At the Mid-Hour of Night. It's a Benjamin Britten piece. Tell us a little
bit
about it.
This is a folk song that was arranged by Britten. Happens to be an Irish folk song. Benjamin Britten, of course, a fabulous composer of major important concert works and operas. But he used to tour around Great Britain and around the world with his boyfriend, Peter Pears, the fabulous tenor for whom he wrote many, many of his works. And they would perform recitals of, you know, Schubert and Fauré and lots of other things, Purcell. And at the end, they would do these encores, and they would choose folk songs that were recognizable sometimes to the audience. And Britten would write these really quirky, really interesting and fun accompaniments for them. And this is one of those that he wrote.
Let's listen to it, At the Mid-Hour of Night.
And I'll sing the wild song which once 'twas rapture to hear. When our voices both mingling breathed as one on the ear. And as echo far off through the veil, I said,
you have a beautiful voice.
Oh,
really,
thanks,
do.
Tish. Thank you.
You know what I have to ask you, too? As somebody who doesn't sing full-time, and is it hard for you to keep your instrument in shape?
It can be, yeah. I try really hard to stay on top of it and to basically, while I'm teaching my students, I really try to be careful about the way I'm demonstrating things so that I'm really, you know, paying attention to my instrument, even though, you know, I spend a fair amount of time in the classroom during the school year up at Ithaca College. And, you know, when I'm working with choirs, we're doing a fair amount of talking about how to enhance what they're doing physically, and I'm in the back of my mind, I'm thinking to myself, okay, remember to keep your tongue, you know, loose, remember to keep your jaw relaxed, etc. So it's a constant thing.
Did you get any formal training during your years as
absolutely. My doctoral degree, in fact, was in voice performance. I just felt really strongly that while I knew I was going to continue to work as a conductor, etc., you know, learning my own technique was really important at that stage in my life.
The
years that I spent at Eastman were phenomenal, both from the standpoint of the things that I learned, the great teachers that I had, but also really fantastic opportunities there. I got the chance to sing some stuff that I don't know that I ever would have had the chance to if I hadn't pursued my doctorate at Eastman at that time.
Now, is performing as a singer and performing as a conductor, because they're both performers, is it an entirely different mindset? How do you approach the two?
It is really different. I mean, from something as very basic as when I'm a conductor, my back is to the audience, and when I'm a performer, obviously I'm facing the audience. It's interesting. It involves me changing my mode from being you know, something of a cheerleader when I'm working with the choir, helping to bring out their best performance that we've worked on in rehearsal, as well as kind of as a curator a little bit. I mean, being that person that's introducing the music to the audience, I really take that very seriously. I think choral music can sometimes seem a little bit inscrutable to some people because they just, you know, maybe they're familiar with the kind of music they sang when they were in school or what their children sing when they're in school. But hearing really fine choral music can take a little handholding. It can take somebody who can introduce it to you in a way that opens it up to you a little bit more. You know, as a performer, interfacing with the audience a little bit more directly, communicating with them really face-to-face is so amazing. I just love it.
So you feel like you're sort of more of a ham and want to be in front of people instead of have your back to them in some ways?
You know, it's it's hard to choose. That's why to this day I continue to do both of them pretty actively. You know, until I'm ready to actually stop singing because physically I'm, you know, just feeling as though it's time to stop. Mm-hmm. I've got a few years left.
I would hope so.
I hope so too. I don't see myself giving up performing professionally as well as, you know, I certainly don't see myself giving up the conducting work that I do because I enjoy them both so much. They're both really rewarding in quite different ways.
You know, I've had several conductors on the show, and I had never talked to conductors, never even thought really that much about hearing about the famous ones like James Levine and stuff. But now I watch conductors when I go to performances, and it is so fascinating to really focus on what you guys are doing.
Absolutely.
Because it really is such a performance.
It really can be.
And I don't understand how James Levine does it in a wheelchair.
Yeah, now, it's remarkable. Remarkable. You know, what a lot of people need to remember when you're watching a conductor is so much of the work has gone before the performance they're actually seeing.
So
what a conductor can do, you know, on the podium can really bring out other things. And one of the things that I learned from Larry Dobler was how little that a conductor really has to do sometimes. That if the chorus in front of you is well prepared, it doesn't take much. It doesn't take huge gestures. It doesn't take, you know, calisthenics to get them to perform the way you want. It can really take just a little bit. And the fun, the electricity of a performance when, you know, the chorus is prepared at a high level and you know that you can just give them that extra little push, that extra little encouragement to be musical and communicative with the audience.
It means you've done your job well.
It means
too,
I've done my job well.
To not have to really work too hard during the performance.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's gotten better as I've gotten older, as I've gotten more experienced.
A lot of the music you focus on with the Cuga Vocal Ensemble and in your own private singing is traditional, classical. What about modern? Are people writing a lot of modern
choral music? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a lot of really interesting stuff going on in choral music. I'm about to take off for a few-day workshop in Washington, D.C., sponsored by Chorus America. Mm. And I'll be hopefully having a chance to chat with some composers who will be there, you know, hawking their wares, hawking their works. And and CVE really does enjoy performing contemporary music. It's just part of the spectrum. You know, it's wonderful to hear choral music that was composed, you know, in 1400, 1500.
Oh, absolutely.
And the intricacies that were possible back then when, you know, they weren't using a computer program to help them do the work. They were doing it in their heads and on paper, and it's pretty miraculous to think about. To hear what is in people's imaginations nowadays, also very exciting. And so I love doing thematic programs where we can do a little bit of both, where we can do some beautiful ancient, and CVE just loves performing music, you know, from the Renaissance. And you know, doing things like singing Messiah. We hope to be performing Messiah this coming December with the CCO, Cayuga Chamber Orchestra. But there's just some incredible.
So there's a mix of both. I usually hear traditional and kind of older music when I hear choirs and and ensembles and so on. Huh? Interesting. I'm glad people are still composing. Now you're a composer. Mm-hmm. What is your subject matter when you're getting ready to compose?
You know, the thing that generally inspires me is a great text. You know, I was talking before about my inspiration to make that arrangement of Coming Through the Rye. You know, I wouldn't put that in the pantheon of great texts. It's
its
original form,
piece.
It was actually pretty bawdy, but such a great Scottish tune, I couldn't resist that. But in general, when I'm composing things myself, You know, I'm on the lookout for a really good text. And I specifically one piece that I wrote a number of years ago that's had a fair amount of success is based on a really wonderful Ralph Waldo Emerson poem. And I was inspired because I heard a setting of it that I thought was dreadful. It was just really clumsy. The way the words were set to music was really poor. And I said, I can really do better than that. And that's exactly what I set to do. I set to really try to do the text justice. And so that was really gratifying. Yeah, finding a really wonderful text to me often is the inspiration.
So that's your starting point.
Yeah.
We are almost out of time. We only have a couple minutes. I was just wondering if we can find Carl rocking out. I mean, do you just listen to classical and traditional music?
No, I don't actually just listen to classical.
Do you like reggae and rock? And,
you know, what I'm really, really interested in right now is traditional Celtic music. I've got a few groups that I really love listening to. There's this woman named Julie Fowlis who grew up in the Outer Hebrides. And hers is the voice in the movie Brave. Mm. She did the singing of the songs in the Disney movie Brave. But she sings in Gaelic with such energy and such passion. And it's, you know, it's real genuine folk music. And
so you rock out to folk music.
I really do. You know, to hear the sound of the bowron and the fiddle and the whistle, and oh, it really stirs something up in me.
Oh, that's so great. That's great. What do you think your life would have been like without music? Can you even entertain the thought of that?
Well, I do have a lot of hobbies. You know, so I suspect it might have been something in visual art, because I really do enjoy doing, you know, visually creative things as well in my spare time. Haha.
Right.
Yeah, so many hobbies, so little time. But no, I just can't, you know, I think come hell or high water, there would be music in my life somehow.
Yeah.
I just think it was destined to be.
It's probably part of your soul. Well, we are almost out of time. Any contact information? Get in touch with you, via the Cuca Vocal Ensemble?
Absolutely. The Cuca Vocal Ensemble. Our website is www.cuca-vocal.org. And watch our website, because it's going to be undergoing a revamp over the summer. And we're going to have information about our 2014-2015 season coming up pretty soon. And yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Carl Johengen. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure. This was really a delight.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.